So entering by communion with primordial reality. This means that you awaken to the essence of the Dharma through the aid of the Buddha's teaching. The teaching touches you directly and it gives you a deep faith, a profound intuitive knowing that a profound faith in your true nature. In fact, you realize that this true nature, which is the nature of everything, is shared by all living beings. This is Buddha nature, deep, profound, mysterious, but covered over by a mass of defilements. Once you've seen this nature, this true nature, this Buddha nature, once you've awakened to it, you then firmly abide in it. You firmly abide, says Bodhidharma, in pikyun, or wall gazing, wall meditation. By wall meditation, he doesn't mean gazing at a wall. By wall gazing, you have to appreciate the symbolism of the wall in East Asian culture. The wall is a symbol of no compromise, no negotiation, no change. You know, up against a wall. You know, no compromise, no negotiation, and no change. So it has the sense of being utterly, firmly established. The wall also symbolizes great strength and trust and wisdom. It symbolizes wisdom because it said, well, a wall faces two ways. It opens two ways. There's this side and that side. So although a wall is very solid, symbolizes this no compromise, no negotiation, it also, paradoxically, it seems, symbolizes openness and emptiness. Because a wall opens two ways, it symbolizes non-duality, the dissolving of self and other, the dissolving of the difference between transcendental and mundane, the dissolving of enlightenment and practice. All those distinctions are dissolved. A great Japanese Zen scholar who's done so much to revise our understanding of early Zen history has said that the translation should not really be wall gazing, but in fact, wall sees or wall observes. It's the wall that's doing the gazing. So in wall gazing meditation, you're firmly abiding, facing both ways. You're firmly established in the non-dual. You're firmly established in the realization that self and other are not separate. This is the true nature of things. You're firmly abiding in a state of silent communion with primordial reality. So this is the first way of entrance, Li Ju. It sounds, I know, rather daunting, but also inspiring, I think. It seems very steep, as the Zen texts would say, to be presented with an entrance into the Dharma, straight into firmly abiding in this primordial reality, this non-dual reality. It rises up like a great blue cliff. Some texts, indeed many Zen texts, say that you cannot awaken to this non-dual primordial reality through a gradual path. It's sudden, immediate. And this kind of approach to things can be misunderstood, and it can be very, very confusing, very confusing. I remember the first, very early on in my involvement in the Dharma, the first day retreat I ever attended was with a Japanese Zen teacher. In fact, he was more than a teacher, he was a Buddha. He was regarded himself as the Buddha Maitreya. But he was a very, very powerful sitter. And we did a day of sitting in silence, and he sat very strongly, very powerfully in full lotus, right in front of the shrine, which I thought was a bit strange, but anyway. And we'd have to go in, and there was no instruction at all. You just had to sit apparently, very uncomfortably for ages. And he would say things like, no need to do anything. And it's all here and now, and things like that. And I went for an interview with him, and it was the same sort of thing. You know, I said, well, what should I do? How should I practice? No need to do anything. Which I found very confusing, because I didn't experience as everything being perfect in itself. And I didn't know how to do nothing. I was only 17, after all. There was even, in his teaching, a certain disparagement of trying to practice precepts and so on. So it was all very confusing and really rather arid, I felt. I found it all so plain and, you know, I just couldn't find a connection anywhere. In the end, you know, maybe it's just my own lack of subtlety. I'm sure that has a lot to do with it. But it was obviously very meaningful for the teacher, but not for me. But I must say, I find Bodhidharma's description of entering through communion with primordial reality inspiring. But in a way, there's nothing you can do with it. It's not something you can do. It comes, it seems, through really opening up to the Dharma. It comes out of a profound receptivity, because the Bodhidharma doesn't just say, well, it just happens. Because he says it comes out of meditating on the teachings or reading particularly the scriptures. Very interesting in the Zen tradition. They talk about different kinds of reading of the Buddhist scriptures. They're not against reading the scriptures, as some people think. But they talk about what's called reality reading. You know, you can read a book where you just skim. You can read a book where you think about every line. But apparently there's another kind of reading called reality reading, where you read intuitively. You just let the text speak directly to your heart. And in the Chan and Zen tradition, the Diamond Sutra especially was approached in this way. One of the main practices in the early Chan and Zen tradition was to recite regularly the Diamond Sutra, or to do reality reading of the Diamond Sutra, or passages from the Lankavatara Sutra. They're not to be studied to accumulate knowledge, but you read it to spark you off. You read with your intuition. You read to be introduced to a vision of reality. And of course, if you have a teacher who can bring the text alive for you, so much the better. Might be worthwhile if you want to have perhaps some feeling for what reality reading might be like. Just have a look at some passages in Bhante's Wisdom Beyond Words, his own commentary on some of the Perfection of Wisdom literature. You get a sense of what reality reading might be like there, as well as a great deal of practical advice on how to practice. So through your reality reading, you're sparked off, you're introduced to the true nature.